There's a lot of connotation, a lot of unnecessary connotation, and I think misconstrued connotation associated with some of those things and ideas, right? Because, you know, they make logical business sense. I think in a lot of other areas of our lives, you know, we pursue things deliberately, intentionally, rationally. You know, we're setting goals that we can achieve that are reasonable. You know, you're not talking to, you know, your significant other about something that is going to, you know, go into Mars tomorrow. And so you're instead right. talking about, you know, driving the car to your next destination. And so I think just a lot of that misconstrued connotation has encouraged behavior, both from investors and entrepreneurs, just doing things that are just unnecessary.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Matt Melimuka. Matt is a co-founder and managing partner at Peakspan Capital. Now, Peakspan Capital has a different approach to venture investing and how they work with and support their portfolio companies. Consider almost the polar opposite of conventional growth at all costs VC investor. So in our conversation today, Matt and I dig into what Peakspan's model looks like in terms of how do you sensibly scale companies and also incremental value creation. And Matt shares what the experience is like for the leadership teams of the companies they invest in. We also dive into some of the steps Matt believes companies should be taking not just to survive, but thrive in the coming economic slowdown. So we get into this and much, much more. But before we get to Matt, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So let's jump into it. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Andy. Excited to be back, and thank you for tolerating me for a second time here.
That's not a problem at all. Not a problem at all. So for people who didn't hear our first episode, tell them a bit about you and what you do.
Sure. So Matt Melimuka, I'm a co-founder and managing partner at Peakspan Capital. So we are a very focused and I hope, you know, more logically oriented, maybe rational, sane growth equity firm. And so we only invest in business software, very focused and specialized within business software because it's such a big market. You know, it's $400 billion plus in annual spend in the US alone. We further specialize, and as partners, we kind of cap the number of proverbial fishing ponds that you can cast your line in to no more than three. And so I lead, for example, our marketing tech, our sales tech, and our hospitality tech efforts. That's all I do. And so I'm, you know, reading a lot of the same stuff as the entrepreneurs that I work with and just trying to get steeped in these industries, almost at a quasi-operator, you know, level, so we can have a really good level of rapport. And then we only invest in what we call the emerging growth phase of company development. There's a lot of different, you know, definitions of what growth means. And I'm sure we'll talk about some, you know, variants of growth strategy on this call today. But for us, it's companies that have gotten past that point of, you know, a PowerPoint and a dream, and you've got some revenue and customers, and you're really looking to, you know, put fuel on the fire, but do so, again, if you're working with us in a more kind of measured incremental way. So that's a little bit about us. The philosophical point, which you and I, you know, kind of waxed on last time, and I'm sure we'll touch on a lot this time, is just how we're structured and how we work with companies, which again is very, very self-aware, very incremental and iterative in terms of kind of the expectations that we set. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who told me a great quote about self-awareness that I think is pretty apropos. It's a Billie Jean King quote, and she said, "You know, self-awareness is the kind of I think something along the lines of self-awareness is the most important ingredient to becoming a champion." And I think there's a lot of truth in that, right? I mean, just understanding where you are as a business, as a person, as an investor, and then just, you know, kind of using that as a baseline and growing together is really what we're all about. And so not overextending yourself, you know, I think there's a lot of really intentionally opaque and unnecessarily opaque elements of venture capital and growth company development where, you know, you're talking about, you know, goals that are unrealistic and, you know, kind of pulling the veil over your own eyes, and it's just not necessary. And so we just take a different approach, and we're in our third fund now. We've got about $1.5 billion under management, offices on the East and West Coast. And I'm here on the East Coast, coming to you live from your city as well. So just really excited to be back.
Yeah. We're actually not that far apart from each other. So, yeah, I mean, you used the words, I was laughing, are you rational, sane? It's like, people don't really associate those words with venture investing very often. So, I mean, when we first met, and I not sure I remember exactly how we first connected, whether I read something of yours.
Cold outreach from yours truly, just how we find our companies. I wrote you a very verbose email about how I wanted to come chat with you.
Yeah, and I was very taken by the philosophy because, you know, when you use these words, intentional, you know, per the Billie Jean King quote, my last book was all about being intentional about how you present yourself to the world as a seller. And it's I think that is the path to success for most companies and for individuals as well.
I think it's interesting. There is there's a lot of connotation, a lot of unnecessary connotation, and I think misconstrued connotation associated with some of those things and ideas, right? Because, you know, they make logical business sense. I think in a lot of other areas of our lives, you know, we pursue things deliberately, intentionally, rationally. You know, we're setting goals that we can achieve that are reasonable. You know, you're not talking to, you know, your significant other about something that is, you know, going to, you know, go into Mars tomorrow. And so you're instead right. talking about, you know, driving the car to your next destination. And so I think just a lot of that misconstrued connotation has encouraged behavior, both from investors and entrepreneurs, just doing things that are just unnecessary. And so that is a hard kind of armor and shield to penetrate sometimes too, right? Some folks just can't get there. And, you know, I think there's a lot of egos in this ecosystem and business as well. And so that plays into it too. But, you know, we are just huge believers in real transparency, you know, thinking about not, you know, what are you going to tell, you know, people at a cocktail party about how much money you raised or what your valuation was, but rather, you know, what kind of company goals are associated with this growth plan? What's the resource you need to get there? And, you know, let's talk about how we get there together. And let's talk about like a two and a half year sprint, because the fog of war is so thick beyond that, you know, mm-hmm. presenting your $1 billion case to my partnership in 5 years, it's just crazy. That's trying to pick up a Powerball winner. And so we just really pursue things incrementally and iteratively.
Yeah. I mean, I worked for this great entrepreneur, built a very successful company, largely bootstrapped, a while ago and before I started my own company. But I always, you know, remember there was a lot of pressure at the time, you know, to go public. This was, you know, before the dot-com bubble burst back, around 2000, and he was just very resistant, and he wasn't, you know, as profitable every quarter of existence, wasn't growing as fast, perhaps top line, as he could have. But he said, you know, the difference is I'm building a company, not a promotion.
It's really interesting. I think that's a great line. And, you know, ostensibly you are starting a company at some point to achieve some level of liquidity or success, right? And so I think, you know, part of our job is, and that can come in very various shapes and forms. And I think that's another element of the craziness, which is this one size fits all approach to both investing and working with companies and, you know, growth strategy and then ultimate exit. There's so many different ways to do it, right? And so we're big believers in really understanding a company's situation and really working collaboratively to create kind of a bespoke path that makes sense. Part of my job, I really do increasingly view as almost like a strategic private wealth advisor too, because I'm helping you hopefully increase value, and we're aligning on how we increase value together in this otherwise illiquid asset. And then part of my job is presenting, you know, potential partial or full liquidity plans and helping you achieve those over time. You know, for example, a lot of the companies that we work with will iterate their way into, you know, the first or second proverbial peak of value creation. We call ourselves peak span because we think it's, you know, multiple successive peaks of value creation versus, you know, sprinting up to the summit. And when we get there, there's a lot of different options we can pursue if we've maintained that optionality, that alignment, and, you know, by virtue of, you know, achieving goals reasonably. You know, you by virtue of, you know, we're not raising, hopefully, you know, so much venture capital to get to that first peak because, you know, you had to do it and grow into that value. You still own a lot of your company. The company is not in a place where they need to raise money, right? You're kind of controlling your own destiny. There's so many different options that you can pursue from there. And I really do think that optionality and doing your best to maintain it at each successive node of the journey versus being forced to go down one path and one path that could be unnatural, that optionality, I think, is the greatest asset in growth company development. I really do believe that.
Yeah. And I think it's, I would say, hey, that's true in career, certainly in sales and so on, is, you know, what you're talking about was interesting is, you know, sort of resisting this urge to follow the one size fits all is I think one of the great lessons that's still largely unlearned or uninternalized, if you will, making up my own word here, in the tech world is that just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should.
Amen. And, you know, I would, you know, take it even further and say, question the status quo too, right? Because just because a lot of other people are doing it, you don't have to be a lemming as well. You know, Andy, I think what's really interesting, I love the line and just the, you know, imagery that it conjures up in your, you know, recent book about nobody bought something because the person was so salesy, or nobody is like seeking somebody to be more salesy, right? It's just such a hilarious but true, you know, adage. And I think the same is true with venture investors. Like, nobody selected a venture investor because they were putting together, like they were being venture-y, right? You work with a venture investor because, you know, you believe that they're going to help you build value in your business. And, you know, there's other elements of it too, but nobody, you know, nobody chose their investment partner because they were such a caricature, if you will, of themselves, right? Like it's almost like this incredible stereotype. And I think a lot of that too is just historically, like, we're in the early innings of, you know, venture as an industry and entrepreneurship and, you know, software in general, right? I mean, you know, this is not manufacturing that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. Like, we're all still figuring this stuff out. And I think, you know, the maturation of the asset class and industry, you know, you can now stay private for as long as you want. You don't really need to go public anymore. There's so much capital. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different just things that have changed. And yet the model and mantra that a lot of investors and companies are kind of pursuing is still that one size fits all. And it's just not necessarily the most, you know, value maximizing way or the most appropriate way to do it.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it's I look at, and you and I've talked about this before, is you know, from a sales perspective, when I look at a lot of these companies and how they're executing their sales plan, there could be top line growth, but the fundamental execution at the sales level is still subpar. I mean, the only way you can characterize it with some of the win rates and so on, it's like, yeah, what's happening here is they're not trying to build a sustainable enterprise, right? They're trying to get to a finish line they've identified. And that encourages behaviors that certainly in the sales side and the marketing side, like I said, that you wouldn't do if you were taking a longer term horizon look at it.
It's totally, yeah, I totally agree. You know, it's like Rome wasn't built in a day, as they say. And, you know, if you have success when you're overextending yourself and you know, building your go-to-market organization before the infrastructure and the processes and the enablement tool, before all of that stuff is in place and the machine is largely, you know, coming together, it's definitionally luck if you have success, right? Because you're getting those Renaissance men and women into the organization that can just kind of figure it out. And it's not really repeatable. It's interesting, Andy, when I look at our portfolio, I think the last time, you know, we spoke, a lot of probably what I was preaching was theory, right? It was like theoretical. This is how we pursue the approach. And you know, we're still a young firm. I'm pleased to you know, report that we have several companies now that have really successfully over the last couple of years pursued this incremental kind of value creation program. And, you know, I think the very logical just response and question that we get a lot is, are you limiting or metering growth potential by your strategy, right? You're kind of, you know, are you limiting potential by limiting and just kind of, you know, metering, you know, goals and stuff like that. And I think the answer is absolutely not from my perspective. We've got three companies now that have really iterated their way into big businesses, all of which we met and partnered with when they were sub 3 million of ARR, all of which are, you know, well over 30 now and approaching unicorn status. And when the self-awareness that those companies and, you know, us as partners have had at each node of the journey is incredible. It's a big, big asset because when we were first talking to those companies, you know, neither we nor the entrepreneurs, nobody was you know, fooling themselves about thinking even, you know, how do we get to 30 of ARR? It was how do we get to 10 in the next couple of years with great resilience, and then let's figure stuff out, right? And so I think those are just great case studies. And by the way, Andy, the sales rep performance, the sales productivity in aggregate, but then the sales rep performance incredibly distributed, incredibly productive, right. which shows that the engines are built there. And the engines have been built before we added fuel to the fire, which we've done now, right? Because it's also appropriate to augment your strategy in the other way. And really, when things are showing that it's ready to get more fuel, sure, of course, we're big believers in that too. So,
yeah, I mean, and I've always thought it's incredibly backwards as you look at the way they're growing some of these organizations, is they sort of fall into the playbook that everybody's using, which, in the software world, is we're talking about 20% win rates oftentimes. And sure, you can scale 20% win rate to a certain point, but at some point, it's going to peter out. But instead of going in and saying, look, this is our product, this is our customers are dealing with, this is how it should be sold, this is the win rate we want to have, and prove to yourself you can achieve that, then scale based on that, you almost never see that take place.
Totally agree. And I think, that's another example too of like that 20%, like a lot of these metrics too now, I just have a problem with, because these benchmarks and like KPIs that people tend to gravitate towards really blindly, are not just appropriate, vectors to measure every company by. And, CAC to LTV to CAC is like a great one where it's an interesting indicator always, but, very often it's not like the best way to measure your business. Right. And so a lot of these things have been so just beaten into people's minds that they think it's like the North Star and the end all be all. And it's just not true. I just think like a lot of these metrics are kind of misguided, or they worked great when they first came about in a specific situation and scenario. But, a lot of my job is really to understand, again, it from a self-aware perspective myself too, how can I help this company? What is this company's position today? I would say some of the best investment opportunities and great, entrepreneurship opportunities too, are not businesses that will, ever be, billion-dollar plus businesses. And that's totally fine. Let's not fool ourselves about it, right? Let's just be honest with ourselves in part and parcel with that is like, if you as an entrepreneur have been building your business for 10 years and you want to seek some partial liquidity to put your kids through college and pay off your mortgage, that doesn't tell me that you don't have confidence in your business. That tells me that you're a logical thinker. And I think that connotation again, of like seeking liquidity in the valley. It's like, how would you ever, it's like Voldemort, like you don't even talk about that because it's crazy, right? And so like this, a lot of these very sane business practices that I actually think are good business practices oftentimes are kind of shunned.
Yeah, well, it's like to some degree that, everybody's sort of this model sort of emerged from Salesforce, and everybody thinks that unless you're going to be a Salesforce, or you should be a Salesforce, or without ever sort of looking at the idea that, well, hey, yeah, this is a different business, a different market we're addressing. That's not going to be $1 billion company, and that's fine.
Totally fine. Yeah, totally fine.
Yeah, we're not Salesforce. Well, so a question I have for you is, when you said you sort of felt like you're swimming against the tide. So when you are talking to investors for your fund, people to put money into you, your limiteds. What do they say about your approach? Because clearly they're hearing pitches from more conventional funds and so on, and you're sort of competing for that money. What are you hearing there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I will tell you, so we're on our third fund now. Our first fund was 150 million. Our second was 265. And our third, which we closed kind of the turn of this year, was 580. And we've grown our fund size by growing the number of people that can lead deals, so partners. And so that's a big juxtaposition to how it's typically done in our space, where you do well and you like consistently double or triple your fund size and you keep the partnership the same. That oftentimes kind of forces you to write bigger checks and go up market. And so our investors really, the conversation has evolved over time. It is raising our first fund and coming, my partners and I, from an evergreen fund structure where we got all of our money from one LP and never, interacted with LPs. It was a harrowing first fundraise, as it always is. And so there was a lot of just skepticism, I think, right, especially early on when we were, preaching the theory, which seemed logical as to can you guys actually do this? But, just in terms of today, I think the prevailing, and this is not meant to be overly pejorative, but I do think it's true. The prevailing venture capital strategy is I'm the smartest guy in the room, and so I'm going to figure it out. Yes. And I have great contacts too, right? There's very little deliberate, like really, really deliberately, intentionally architected strategy. We could not be more different. So we are such a process-centric organization. We think so hard about just every element of our business. And we kind of think about ourselves as a strategic sales team too. You know, my job is to sell money and you know, hopefully sell money to companies that don't need it, which is an interesting quandary. But we think really hard about process centricity. We really view ourselves as well as a product organization. So, you know, we are offering a product and it has value. What is that product and who are we selling it to? What do they need? What do they look for? And so our investors really gravitate towards the focus and specialization, you know, which hopefully breeds expertise and really just a tight kind of consistent roster of experience that's relevant. And then just a really, really, I would say kind of placid, less volatile outcome expectation, whereby, you know, our expectation is that we're going to, our baseline is three times or more of our money. And we just don't lose money, you know, contrasted to the kind of the status quo venture strategy, which is, you know, you'll have a couple home runs, but a lot of losses. And so we've across our three funds, we've never lost money to date. And so our returns have been very, you know, very kind of very crowded around the kind of the median, if you will, which is very just consistent. That was increased, I will say, the last couple of years with the markets where they were. Sure. Which is great, but you know, just focused and specialized and really staying on Hymnal. A lot of our investors thought we were going to move up market, and we haven't. So we're really trying to build, you know, the category leader in this space.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're talking about to me sort of strikes me. Sort of what I like to talk about is this idea that we sort of have this idolatry of what we consider top performers to be. Yeah, you know, whether it's in sales or as companies. You know, innovators, and being good has become like a pejorative, right? It's like, you tell someone you're good at something, it's like, well, you're not one of the top 10%. What's wrong with you?
Well, it's so interesting too. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah. But I was going to say is it sounds like what you're focused on is, yeah, we want people who are consistently good. They're building these enterprises and yeah, we may not get the home runs of certain magnitude, but as a group, everybody's doing well.
Well, think and think about this too, right? At the end of the day, a portfolio return, right? We're portfolio managers. The portfolio return is a math equation, right? It's you know, there's a lot of variables, and our performance, I'm happy to say, has absolutely been top decile. How we get to that top decile performance is different, right? And so I actually. Right. I take a lot of solace and comfort in just giving what I view to be sage, rational, sane business advice to the teams that I work with, and very transparently so, versus a model whereby I could not, you know, sleep well at night with this EKG of like, this company is going to Mars and this company is dying tomorrow and I don't have time to go to the board meeting. Like, that's crazy. And you're you know, if you're successful in either, you're getting to the same place, right? The same end kind of solution and output. And so there's a ton of different ways to do it. I just think that model is in my view very misaligning. It's unnecessary. I think just the supply and demand equation has shifted in software and with money and you just don't need to pursue it as much as it's pursued anymore. And yeah, I do think I hope our investors take a lot of, you know, take a lot of comfort in that, because we're right. I will tell you that we will, you know, attract interest from the more, you know, white-haired organizations and, you know, pension fund managers, et cetera, that would never even like look at venture. They'll take a meeting with us, which is great.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about what your strategy feels like for, you know, CEO that you've invested in and their senior team and so on. So when you talk about sensible scaling, your incremental value creation, let's break that down. What's that? Yeah. How's that look different for them in their work experience?
Totally. And I have a whiteboard next to me. I was literally just with one of my CEOs from a really neat business called Connecto before we did this session. And so actually what we did there, just a real world anecdote, and then I'll answer the question. we were literally whiteboarding. We had a session yesterday with a couple of our operating advisors who are just really heavy hitting folks that have put together this great workshop. It's the former head of product from PayPal, this guy Howard Bell, and the former president of NetSuite, Pete Daffern. They're excellent at ideal customer profile refinement and just really, really granularly figuring out, you know, who you're going after, and then associated kind of positioning and, you know, go to market mechanization, if you will. And in those sessions, a lot of those sessions to me, I've worked with these guys for years and years, are really interesting because just forcing yourself to say out loud some of the stuff that you've known in your gut as a business is always interesting, right? And there's always various views around the table as to like who your ideal customer profile is and all that stuff. And I love those just workshops because there's a lot of great case studies, some of which people don't really know. Like, you know, DocuSign, for example, when they were first starting out, 75% of their customers were lawyers until they were like 50 million of revenue. And so that you have this aspirational vision of being a broad-based, you know, e-signature provider, but under the hood, operationally, you're super focused on a tight ICP. And so to answer your question, when we work with companies, back to the self-awareness point too, we are not operators. You know, I'm a former investment banker and I've spent all of my career working with growth stage companies now on the growth equity side for years and years and years. So there are skills that I bring to the table that are complementary to the skills that you have in-house as a business. And there are skills that I lack, right? Because I don't have operational experience. And so we've surrounded ourselves with really two different tiers of operating advisors to bring that full kind of full package to bear for an entrepreneur. And so this guy, you know, Pete and Howard are great examples on the ICP side. We have Carl Sukahara, the former CMO of Optimizely, who does great kind of marketing funnel diagnostics. Mm-hmm. And so we try to kind of swarm in this company Connecto. I just invested in very recently. And so we're setting up these sessions with these operating advisors to really just diagnose and get a baseline check of kind of where each functional group is, you know, where do we have holes, you know, where do we need to supplement the team, where do we need to build, you know, better process and infrastructure. And, you know, the sane and rational point from all of that is really coming out of that work, we will kind of build from the ground up, what does this all imply in terms of the resource we need for the next, you know, year and a half, 2 years, and a reasonable expectation of where we can scale to. And so that all, like that work will dictate, you know, what the plan should be and what we should all align mm-hmm. around versus starting with the plan, right? And so that, I think that's something that is often just a tricky way to do it, because then you're kind of like, all right, so how do we get to this growth number and this ARR number? And then you're kind of backfilling from there versus just really, you know, again, looking at what you can do naturally and what you can digest, you know, palpably, and taking it from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different, well, as you said before, it's a sane and rational learning curve that you're going through as a company, right? Because I always found in the startups I'd worked on is that, you know, revenue growth was never a linear, straight linear line. It was sort of step function up, right? And you learned really hard lessons along the way by maybe stretching a little to take something that was going to teach you something new to make you better, but not investing all in on, hey, here's an incredible optimistic plan that we're going to go after and not hitting it.
Totally. Right? And the benefit of my role, like I really believe that the biggest, you know, value and impact I can bring to a business is just the benefit of my experience, because a lot of operators I'm working with, even if it's your third company, I've had the benefit of working with 33 companies. And so just that experiential asset, like I've seen so many things so many times, and I've touched a hot stove and burned my finger a lot too. And so it's out of that scar tissue that you see these things bubbling up to the fore, and you can talk about them and try to head them off at the pass. And so, you know, like the, you know, biting off more than you can chew. Of course, like I've worked with several companies where we landed a big customer right out of the chutes, and we're like, all right, let's hire a bunch of reps, and it didn't work out, right? And so it's through those learnings that you kind of that I can, again, just, you know, I can relay the benefit of my experience, and that's when there's collaboration and folks are open to that. It's, you know, it's that's when like really good things can happen.
So let's put this in the context then of sort of perhaps economic slowdown that's looming. My contention is that a lot of companies that have been too aggressive up front and then with low win rates, they're going to have to actually learn how to sell in an economic slowdown, because suddenly you've got a lot of competitors competing for a smaller pool of dollars, or a pool of dollars is not growing as fast as it was before. So, when in your mind, sort of the companies, you look at companies, what are they really should be focusing on with regard to execution?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you told me a story about one of your companies where you had 28 sellers and 26 of them hit their number. And so it's like, okay, there's a company that knows how to set goals, knows how to manage people, knows how to build confidence. Seems like they're probably an example of somebody be pretty resilient as a slowdown company.
It's a great point. You were referencing Cognizant, which is a business, I've worked with, James Isolay, the founder of the team there since 2019, when again, they were like 3 million of ARR, and we'll finish this month close to 40. That business and that team is like this incredible process-centric engine. They actually have a really interesting model whereby they've developed this farm system. They're based in London, and they've only ever hired students out of university to be SDRs, and then top performing mm-hmm. SDRs become SDR managers and ultimately AEs. They've never hired an AE laterally, and that's produced this incredible distributed performance. But right. I think on the economic environment point, what's interesting to me, again, on the self-awareness point, yeah, I could probably make the case, and I'm sure you could too, as to why most business software companies are recession-proof or resilient. You can also, conversely make the case as to why they're exposed, right? And so I think part of it is really just understanding how you might want to augment your value prop and the things that you are going to drive home to potential prospects and conversations. Like, are there elements that are different, that are more, top of mind for potential prospects and customers here going into an environment like this, cost savings versus, versus growth or stuff like that. I think the beauty of our strategy is because we are not, taking flyers, and these companies are really, again, deliberately architected and really just rationally run. Most of the companies we work with can be in a place of kind of controlling their own destiny. Every company we invest in, by the way, we underwrite to never needing to raise more money. We do often, but we don't need to raise more money. And so all the companies we work with are in a place where if they needed to, they could get back to, self-sustaining, break-even, or profitability. But I think moreover, what we're seeing is, the impact of the economy in sales conversations I've seen has yet to really, really flow in. I think we're still right there. We're like on the precipice where, a lot of these conversations that you're having now, especially if you're in a more large enterprise segment, you've been in discussions with them for months, right? And so it's probably not indicative right. of where we will be. But I, every day I wake up and read a different headline about how, things are going to get crazier and crazier. And you have, the inverse yield curves, which are always like the, predictor mm-hmm. of pending doom. And I think the disparity of the yield curves is the highest it's ever been since like 1980 or something, which is scary. And so I think all of the teams I work with, again, which is really refreshing, because I think there's self-selection in our model in working with us and choosing to work with a partner like us. All of these entrepreneurs like have actually proactively come to me and said like, all right, here's what we're thinking about in terms of, again, value proposition, augmentation, and, kind of growth and investment posture rejiggering versus me needing to come to them. So that's just an awesome, awesome, refreshing thing as a partner where they're already thinking about all this stuff and we're just collaborating together, assuming degradation in performance and productivity. What do we need to look like from a resource perspective to get through this?
Right. Well, and I think that if they've more focused, or like Cognizant, if they've got such a high fraction of their reps performing at a level where they want them to perform, means they've really dialed in on the ICP extremely well, means they understand their process, they're doing a great job with discovery and qualification, and it means they're spending their time selling to people that want to buy what they have to sell.
Absolutely,
And that's a big gap for most software companies, is they're selling to anybody that they basically consider a qualified opportunity, loosely qualified, as opposed to, no, if they're qualified, they're qualified to buy our product.
Well, totally. And Andy, I think that the unfortunate reality too is there's a supply and demand imbalance in software. Make no mistake about it. There are a lot of software companies that are desperately looking for a market need to solve that should not be around. Right. And you know, if a business is like, my job is to find real, in my view, like meat and potatoes businesses that are driving a specific outcome or actually, you know, delivering value. Like if you are a peripheral software tool, it's just tough, to your point. And you know, you might have success by, you know, overloading the top of the funnel and you know, to your point, running a promotion and having a 20% win rate. But especially when things get, you know, the purse strings get tighter in an economic environment like this, a lot of these tools that are like nice to haves and, you know, additive to the tech stack in some way, but are really not fundamentally, you know, outcomes based and core to what you're doing, like those are going to be tough to you know, to stick around.
Yeah. A lot of consolidation, a lot of opportunity. Well, maybe, hey, maybe your companies will get into acquisition mode at some point.
Totally. It's always an option. Feels vulture-y to say that, but it is you know, always a potential path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there'll be some assets that'll be less expensive going forward than they are today. So, all right. Well, Matt, well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you back on the show again. If people want to connect with you, what's the best way to do it?
Absolutely. Andy, really appreciate you having me back for part two here. It's always a pleasure. You guys are absolute just experts at what you do. I love listening to the podcast. So really appreciate you having me back.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course. No, you guys are awesome. You can reach me on email. It's just matt@peakspancapital.com. Check out our website. We've got some really cool, we're doing a website relaunch soon, and we've worked hard to try to build content pieces, and we have a whole masterclass series of recordings on our website. And so at the end of the day, we want to be helpful to entrepreneurs. Like, I'm a big believer in business karma. And so check out our website, not to be self-promotional, but because there is some really hopefully helpful content out there. And so feel free to ping me if there's a way to work together. Awesome. But if not, totally happy to be helpful however I can. So,
all right, Matt, thanks so much. Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Matt Melamuka, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thank you for your help with that. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.